Good evening. My name is Elaine, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Todd, for asking me to speak tonight on Tradition 8. My immediate reaction when he asked was like, me? Why me? It's like, there was a time that I just zoned out when the traditions were read. Like, to me, they were just a blur of words. I didn't even comprehend them. I didn't really listen to them. But I guess that's because back in the beginning, I was focusing on my 12 steps. And then in the last year or so, I realized that I wanted to know more. I wanted to know more about the traditions, and I have been reading a lot about them and studying them. And so I guess I should be up here sharing on the 8th. The traditions are kind of like the glue that keeps us together. The steps are what keeps me personally sober. The traditions are like what keeps us as a group functioning, keeps the group sober. And in the seventh tradition, we learned that... Now I've gone blank. In the seventh tradition, we learned that, well, money and spirituality don't mix. We learned that, I'm just going to move right along. Tradition 8, the short form. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our server centers may employ special workers. And then the long form of that is Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, and we define professionalism as the occupation of counseling alcoholics for fees or hire. But we may employ alcoholics when they are going to perform these services for which we might otherwise have to engage non-alcoholics. Such special services may be well recompensed, but our usual AA 12-step work is never to be paid for. The traditions were designed to produce spiritual unity, and we've learned over and over again that spirituality and money do not mix. Except, of course, in the basket. The 8th tradition is very simple and it's very concise. We don't ever pay for 12-step work, ever. And as we're alcoholics, we need to keep things simple because I know me as an alcoholic, I tend to really complicate things. On page 63 of our big book, we are told that we had a new employer. Being all-powerful, he provided what we needed. If we kept close to him and performed his work well, that's how I do my 12-step work, and that's how I keep close to God. I pass on freely to others what was so freely given to me. And here is how Bill W. would describe AA's 12-step work. It's almost entirely unorganized and completely non-professional. This mighty spiritual current is now flowing from alcoholics who are well to those who are sick. One alcoholic talking to another. That's it. No AA will tolerate the idea of paid AA therapists or organizers. Money and professionals would and always dilute the message and fail to provide the life-giving stream. A year before I came in here to the room of Alcoholics Anonymous, my therapist had asked me, would I ever consider going to an AA meeting? And I was totally horrified and insulted that she would ask me such a question because she, of all people, should know everything I was going through and that alcohol was not my problem. And I was genuinely horrified that she would ask me such a thing. But she had listened to me for like weeks and months on end. Of course she would. So in the early part of 2009, I started checking out a few meetings in my neighborhood. And so at our next session, I told her that I'd been to a couple of AA meetings. And she was very quiet. She didn't react. She didn't say anything. And she let me talk and carry on and have my say. And at the end, she handed me a piece of paper with a phone number on it. And she asked me to call this girl and to talk to her. So I did, probably about a week later. And no, I did like the day before I was going back to see her. And that girl was Amy M. And Amy brought me here to Atlantic Group. She introduced me to my sponsor. She introduced me to my home group. She introduced me to everything. She introduced me to a life beyond my wildest dreams. My therapist, I don't know if she knew about our 8th tradition or whether knowingly or unknowingly, she honored it and she knew that she couldn't convince me to come in here, but that Amy could, and she did. So, anyway, back to facts, statistics, 8th tradition. There is a small percentage of people in AA that are paid professionals, like cooks, secretaries, janitors. They are not paid to do 12-step work, but they are paid to make 12-step work possible. Letters need to be mailed, phones need to be answered, literature needs to be shipped. AA lifelines need to be tended. So we hire people. We hire people and pay them, not as paid alcoholics, but as paid workers. Many members of AA choose full-time careers as counselors in rehabs, detoxes, and hospitals. There's probably quite a number here. But they do not professionalize AA's 12-step. They honor our tradition of anonymity. In 1944, Mary Mann, one of the first women in AA, started to educate the public about alcoholism, and she had the full support of Dr. Bob, Bill W., and other early AAs. They saw then that organizing and fundraising necessary for public education on alcoholism were outside AA's ability and primary purpose. There is also the case that most of us know of Tom, the janitor from the old clubhouse on 24th Street. When asked if he would clean up, make coffee, and keep an eye on the clubhouse with no pay, they figured he had a fireman's pension. His response was, okay, no money, no work. I do my 12-step work for free, but if you're going to have me here as a janitor, then you are going to have to pay me. In order for AA to function, we had to hire some help. I did a lot of reading and research, and it's kind of interesting. Maybe I'm becoming like an AA nerd or something, but I do. I find it interesting. I like the history. I like the different characters that you find along the way. And one of them is Bill L., who was a friend of Lois and Bill W. And he published the A Tradition Checklist in December of 1970 in The Grapevine, Volume 27, Number 7. And here's what he had to say. It finally became apparent to me, even back in 1945, that New York AA had to have someone who would be responsible full-time for making sure their telephones got answered, that calls for help were referred quickly to some dependable, sober member near the caller, that new prospects who wandered in were 12-stepped, that information of times and locations in all the greater New York meetings were kept up to date, that mail asking for help was answered, that rent and phone bills were paid, and that the place was cleaned up. Unless we made one person responsible full-time for all these chores, all of us would suffer, especially the newcomer. We wanted prospects to get an instant and careful help, not to be forgotten about. So we agreed that we had to have a full-time secretary who would provide those services for all members of the groups in the vicinity. And we decided it would have to be someone who could be fired if she did not do the job properly. I like the she bit. It never occurred to anyone, I believe, that we ought to have a non-member in order to keep AA non-professional. It seemed perfectly obvious that the only sort of person equipped for this job would be a member of some experience both in sobriety and local AA. No non-member could possibly understand all that had to be done and how to do it in the traditional AA way. Of course, our secretary would have to be someone with office skills, able to write letters, handle their own filing, and keep some primitive records, write checks, etc. Perhaps that is why, when I was asked, as in Bill L. was asked, many years later, whether I would do a writing job for pay at our AA General Service Board, I could say yes with a clear conscience. Since I earned my living writing, I was simply selling the skill to AA exactly as I often sold it to other various clients. The board paid me for my professional service, but here I would like to notice, AA has never paid me, nor has ever paid anyone, to admit I was powerless over alcohol, to go to meetings, to take my personal inventory and discuss it with someone, to make amends to those I had harmed, to admit it when I am wrong, to use prayer and meditation, and to show responsible concern for newcomers. In short, I have never known any member hired in our offices and service centers to pay for staying sober. So now I'll just quickly go through the A Tradition Checklist, and it's a good way to kind of keep you on the beam, see where you are in your sobriety. The first one is my own behavior accurately described by the traditions? If not, what needs changing? I constantly need changing. When I chafe about any particular tradition, do I realize how it affects others? I used to, but now I'm learning about them, and I like them, and I'm enjoying them. Do I sometimes get a reward, even if not money, for my personal AA efforts? And this is where I have to be very careful of my ego. Do I try to sound in AA like an expert on alcoholism or recovery or medicine or sociology or AA itself, on spiritual matters or, heaven help me, even on humility? And I would probably be guilty of all. Do I make an effort to understand what AA employees do, what workers and other alcoholism agencies do? Can I distinguish clearly among them? And I'm learning. I'm trying to learn. In my own AA life, have I any experience which illustrates the wisdom of this tradition? I like to 12-step openly and freely, and it's really what keeps me sober, is connecting with newcomers and with other people. And then the final one on the checklist is, have I paid enough attention to the book 12 Steps and 12 Traditions, to the pamphlet AA Tradition, how it developed? And I'm very happy to say that my 12 and 12 is totally earmarked from cover to cover. There was a time when the front bit was kind of marked and stained and the back bit was very pristine and clean, but that's not the case now. So I thank you. I thank you for my sobriety, and that's it. Thanks.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Michael.
Hello, my name is Michael. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is November 7th, 2012. I'm a member of the Atlantic Group. My sponsor is Jamie J, and I'm currently working the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank Preacher for asking me to speak. And, I never thought I would speak in front of this many people sober nonetheless. If I could describe my alcohol story in one word, it would be sad or lonely. When I came into the rooms of AA, I want to say a message to the newcomer. Please don't try to differentiate yourself from my story or how I'm describing my feelings. You know, if hopefully I can say something that you will be able to relate to, or some situation you were in or some feeling that you felt. And if not, please don't think that you may actually not be an alcoholic, because there are plenty of other people in this room that I'm sure you'll be able to relate to. Normally when I like to speak about myself, I only like to say good things. However, in order to get my story across and to let you know how I got to where I am today, I have to go through some of my darker periods. When I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I wanted to blame everyone but myself. I wanted to blame my parents for sheltering me too much, for not giving me enough freedom. I wanted to blame my friends for not understanding me or not appreciating me as much, but today, I've truly realized that I'm here solely because of myself and my own actions that I took and my own feelings that I feel. Growing up, I had and I still do have a great supportive family. They really gave me everything that I could have asked for and more. Friendships were a little trickier. I like to say that I often felt second tier. When it came to friendships, I felt, whether these were thoughts made up in my head or not, I felt that other people did not appreciate me as I appreciated them. Other people didn't like me as much as I liked them. You know, I called people and they didn't call me back as much. And that kind of, forced me, got me tired and kind of drew me into a little isolation from the start. So I was ready to, once high school was winding down, I was ready to move on, and I was, ready to go to college, live on my own, no supervision, and I was ready to finally drink how I wanted to. And that did quickly backfire the first weekend when I did get in trouble for alcohol and dry good, which I will not touch upon. So my first weekend at college, I did get suspended, and I was sent home for the whole semester. And while that is funny, so I was looking forward to making new friendships and new relationships, and being sent home that first week really kind of threw a curveball towards me. And then while other people, all their freshmen were meeting each other, I was at home. And I took courses at community college, I got a job, and I started drinking alone. And, I thought that other people, all my other friends that I had, they're off in college, they're drinking, why can't I drink? And this proved to be a pattern throughout the next few years. So I did go back to the school for the next two semesters, and during those times I did get two more minor alcohol violations, and I felt that it was in my best interest if I leave that school, take a semester off, and apply elsewhere. So that's what I did. I went back home for the semester. I worked an internship. I applied to other schools, and I drank alone again because I just had that craving, and you know that's what I wanted to do. And during this time of applying to other schools, I applied to a school that was regarded as a higher academia. And I knew that when applying to schools, I couldn't escape the suspension that was on my record. So I actually wrote in my college essay about getting suspended due to alcohol. And I got into a better school than I was at. So while one would have thought that alcohol had a consequence on me, it actually got me into a better school, indirectly, of course. And one of the worst questions that my parents would ask me is, why is this time going to be different? And I truly believe that this time was going to be different every single time, but I was not willing to change my actions, and the situation's never changed. You know, I was at this new school. I had made friends, but I had also isolated myself and sheltered myself, and towards the start of my drinking, I used drinking and alcohol as a way to become more social, and it worked for a long time. And then up until a certain period, it stopped working. And what I mean by that is I still did get drunk, but I did not get the same outcomes from the alcohol that I had originally used it for. It just caused me to isolate more and feel more and more uncomfortable, and I was just digging into a deeper and deeper hole. And, you know, towards the end of my drinking career, I knew that I had a problem, but I would never admit it on my own because I wasn't willing to change. I knew that if I had a problem, there had to be a solution, and in order for there to be a solution, that had to mean I had to do something about it, and I wasn't ready. You know, and if it weren't for my parents and my therapist sitting me down and recommending rehab, you know, I wouldn't be here today. And it always amazes me how people come here on their own. I know that if it weren't for that little outside intervention, I wouldn't be here today, so I'm very thankful for that. So I did go to rehab. It proved well for me. It really made me realize that I actually did have a problem. You know, people don't just go to rehab. And then I moved into Manhattan. I lived in a sober house to get so that I didn't go out into the city on my own. I needed a little supervision, and then shortly after that, I moved out on my own. And there was one thing I heard that someone had said at a meeting that was, you know, I've never seen anyone come into the meetings, go out, drink, and then come back and say that, oh, it actually wasn't that bad out there, guys. And I was thinking in my head, you know what, like, I'll be that person. Like, I want it to be different. And I had that mental arrogance, you know, I didn't act it out, but I felt that way, and that caused me to relapse. And of course, I just relapsed the same exact manner that I had been drinking before. And thank God that I came back into the program 2 months later, maybe. And I found the Atlantic Group, and I chose the Atlantic Group to be my home group because I saw a lot of kind, sweet, loving faces, and that attracted me to this group. And, you know, I picked a sponsor because I saw something in him that I wanted in me. And, you know, if I were to suggest something to the newcomer, it would be to pick up a sponsor and to work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And go to meetings. And the great thing about this program is that, you know, if you want to, you really can make it whatever you want. The things that I would suggest, though, is that those two things of getting a sponsor and working the 12 steps. Other than that, you can take direction from your sponsor. You know, there are tons of different ways. You don't have to run it a certain way. And that's been huge in my recovery, as I've seen, you know, countless people do this thing differently. Go through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous differently. You know, I've done what's worked for me, and that's why I'm here today. You know, there is no vaccination for alcoholism. There's only a solution, and that solution is here in AA, and that's why I have to continue to come back. And you know, I've definitely grown in this program. You know, one thing, I used to like to solve my problems on my own. I was too proud to reach out for help, and now if I have a problem in life, I'm able to call a few people and really talk it out, and that's been a huge blessing. And you know, I've made a lot of lasting relationships in here, and I've just had tons of support. And you know, oftentimes I hear people say they have a life beyond their wildest dreams. I'm not currently there yet. I'd be lying to say if I were, but I know that if I continue to stay on this path, you know, it's inevitable. Hopefully for me to reach that point, if I keep doing the work and if I keep, you know, helping other people. So thank you.
Our main speaker tonight is Owen.
Okay. Hi, everybody. My name is Owen Riley, and I'm an alcoholic. And, let me qualify first and tell you that my regular meeting, my home group is the Wednesday night Pacific group meeting in Los Angeles. My sponsor is Clancy I. And my sobriety date is December 23rd, 1986. And I currently live in Santa Barbara. And I don't know if you've heard about it, but we have a severe water shortage there right now. It's a severe drought. So I just stopped in for the water tonight. And I'm leaving. Thank you very much. So I came here to attend a wedding up in Connecticut, and I came down, and Lisa graciously showed me around Lower Manhattan today. It was quite a treat. We were talking earlier about AA and kind of what it's done for us in. If I don't say anything tonight, I need to tell you that, as far as I'm concerned, Alcoholics Anonymous has made me eligible for all the good things in life. That's basically what it's done for me. Without AA, or before AA, I was not eligible to play. I wasn't allowed to get up to swing at the ball. Okay, I wasn't allowed in the game. I couldn't make it out of the dugout. Today, I can get up, and sometimes I hit a home run, sometimes I hit into a double play. But that's life, you know. But at least I'm eligible. I'm in the game. I can play it. And before I could you know barely walk. I grew up here in New York. I grew up in Flushing. That's where I was bred and buttered, as they say. We have a lot of people here from Queens. I see a lot of blank stares. It's right over the river. Okay. I like to tell everybody that I was an only child, and that really pissed off my brother and two sisters. But I had no idea they existed. I was so self-centered from childhood that I didn't even know that I never considered them in anything. They were never a part of anything. I would never say, oh, I can't do this because my sister might get in trouble or my brother. They just weren't part of it. I had no concept of the fact that I had siblings. It was me, you know, and I tell them that today. I said, you know, I was an only child, and they say, yeah, we know you were, you know. I want to tell you a little bit what it's like, just so that I can qualify, because I think it's extremely important that if you're new here tonight, that you know that I have the same disease you have, okay. And this is just one incident, how it manifested itself in my life. Around late 1985, I had been divorced, and I was living in I lived in Connecticut prior to that, and I had gotten divorced, and I took off for San Antonio, Texas, and after San Antonio, I moved to Dallas, and I was trying to go to AA meetings, you know, off and on. I went through a recovery. Two recovery places down there. One was aversion therapy, where they they put you in a bar. You know, there was a bar in the hospital, and they serve you drinks, and they thought that was going to stop me. That's the only time I ever made a profit on a hospital bill, you know. But a company came forward and wanted to hire me in Los Angeles, and they moved me. They packed up all my belongings. They even put my car on the truck. They moved me, and they gave me like a couple of weeks to find a place in L.A., and I came out, you know, first class, and they flew me out, and a realtor met me and drove me around Los Angeles until I finally found, you know, a place to live. And then the movers showed up and moved me in and unpacked the boxes and put the dishes away. And the following Monday, after this company had moved me, paid for the entire move, paid for my relocation expenses and so forth and so on, I reported to work on Monday morning. The guy that I was going to work for showed me around, showed me my new office, introduced me to some people, people who would be working for me and people I'd be working for. And about 11 o'clock in the morning, Monday morning, the first day on the job, he called me into his office, and he slid an envelope across the desk at me, and he said, "Here, this is for you." And I said, and I opened it up, and it was a check for like, you know, $2,000 or something. And I said, "What's this?" And he said, "Well, we know when you move, there's a lot of out-of-pocket expenses that are just not covered. So this is for you, just, you know, for your out-of-pocket expenses, and thank you very much." And I said, "Thank you very much. This is really nice." And I took that check, and, 45 minutes later, I went down to a bank that was in the building, down on the main floor of the office building. I cashed the check, and they never saw me again. Okay? I got drunk. I took the $2,000 and got loaded. That's what I do when I drink, okay? I mean, that was a really tough amends, by the way. But because apparently the guy who hired me got fired, you know, over that. But those are the kinds of things. I mean, you know, you may not have done anything exactly like that, but if you can identify with that kind of just inability to just show up, you know, inability to get out of the dugout. I couldn't do it. I just went off on a tear, and I finally was held up in an apartment in Marina Del Rey, and I finally, out of desperation, I called Alcoholics Anonymous, and some guy came and knocked on my door, okay? And that was the beginning of the beginning for me. I'd like to tell you that I got sober immediately, but that didn't happen. This guy was a professional comedian, and he and I became really good friends, and I didn't know it at the time. I it was something I had to learn the hard way, but instead of being my sponsor, he became a friend, and we started doing things together. We go to basketball games together, and so forth and so on. And when he would tell me to do something, I'd kind of, you know, he'd tell me to go to a meeting. I'd say, "Yeah, you know, if you go, I'll go," kind of thing. It was this kind of friendship thing, and that doesn't work for me. I need a sponsor. My sponsor today is not my best friend. I don't call my sponsor up and say, "Let's go out and, you know, and see a Lakers game and, you know, have hamburgers or something." Okay, we don't usually do that. The relationship I have with my sponsor is better than my best friend, because I would tell my sponsor something that I don't like about my best friend that I may not tell my best friend. Okay? That's just the way it is. But I kind of had to learn to do it the hard way. So I had 8 months of sobriety, and I came back here on a business trip. I had gotten another job, and I came to New York on a business trip, and I was staying at the Plaza Hotel, and I sat down for dinner. They had an early dinner, and I sat down at the table, and the waiter came over and turned the wine glass over and poured me a glass of wine, and I drank it, okay? And I was off and running again. It was just that simple. I had a few drinks that night and went up to my room and woke up the next morning, and it was like, "Oh, my God, it turns out I'm not an alcoholic." Yeah. And I was thinking about how embarrassing this is going to be to go back to these nice people in L.A. and thank them for all their help, but it turns out that it was a false alarm, and I'm fine. And I went about my business that day and came back to the Plaza that evening, and I had about maybe six drinks, or 6 or 7, whatever it was. And the next morning I woke up and I had a little bit of a hangover. You know, you just could feel a little bit. And so I remember saying to myself, well, that's it. So I know my limit is 3. Okay, I got it now. I figured this out. My limit's 3. That's all I'm ever going to have ever again in my whole life. I'll only have 3 drinks. And I went out and did business that day and came back that night and drank an entire bottle of scotch. So my last drink was at the Oak Room of the Plaza Hotel, which isn't too far from here. In fact, I still like to walk by and look at the bar stool I sat on when I did it. But, that was the last drink, and they poured me onto a plane and sent me back to L.A., and the guy who was sponsoring me met me, and he drove me to the Pacific Group and kind of, opened the door and pushed me out with his foot and said, go in there, maybe those people can help you, And so I ended up in the Pacific Group. It's a big group like this. And by the way, where do they keep the alcoholics? This is such a good-looking group. I haven't seen one tattoo or one piercing. I mean, this is unbelievable. So what a great-looking group. I don't believe you're alcoholics. I think you're props, okay? I do not believe. But so anyway, it's a big group. It's like this, and great enthusiasm for AA, and I kind of got, swept up in it. I had made the decision at that point in time, after I had my last drunk, that what I was going to do was, I have a couple of kids by my first marriage, so what I was going to do was I was going to go back and either straighten out the job that I had or get another job, get life insurance, and then kill myself. The thing that scares me about suicide is I'm not one of these cry for help people. I'm going to do it. And I had a great relief come over me when I decided that was my course of action. That I was, this. If you're going to off yourself, late bills don't mean a lot. it's like, so what? I don't care if the telephone doesn't get paid. I won't be alive, when it happens. So that's kind of the attitude I took. So I started, my idea was to go, to this specific group in order to stay sober for the 90 days or whatever it was for the insurance to kick in. That's what I believe. And what happened, and if you're new here tonight, this may happen for you, and you may not know it, because when it happened to me, I didn't have the emotional or spiritual vocabulary to describe it. But when I went to these meetings and I heard you people talk about the things that you did, because I thought, I was kind of a despicable person to do things like I did, but I heard you kind of share either things that were just as bad and in some cases worse than what I did. And what I started to do is I started to get this thing called hope. Okay? And we speak about it, but that's what it was. It was just a little pilot light. It just came on and I just started believing maybe I can do this. Maybe it's possible for me to do this. It just might be. And if you're like I am, what happens, as soon as that little light of hope comes on, it's almost snuffed out by the immediate onrush of a thing called fear. Okay? Because as soon as I got hope, I got afraid, because I said, okay, so now what, you aren't kidding me about this, doing making amends, and I know what the fifth step is. It's confession. I was raised Catholic. So, you weren't kidding. I knew, and it was kind of like, I can't do all that. And I became afraid. But what you have to do is match that fear with faith, So I kind of got hope and started working on faith. That's really what I did. And I got Clancy was my sponsor. I asked him to sponsor me. I made a deal with God, I said, if I'm going to make a deal with the devil, I'm going to make a deal with you, God, and I'm going to go. And if this guy will sponsor me, I'll just do whatever he tells me to do. Okay, that's what I agreed to do. And I went down to the mission. I sat with him, and we spoke for a while, and he took on my case. And he was a guy that I would just, bounce things off of. And I had to very early on explain to him my suicide plan, okay, which he said, if you still want to do it, you you're welcome to go ahead and do it, but, let's talk about it. If you're new here tonight, please share your plans with God and your sponsor, okay? Give them a laugh, because if you had plans like I had, you know, it's really unbelievable. So you got, and he still sometimes laughs at what I have to say. You know, I'm very insulted. I have all this sobriety and tell him something, and, you know, the next thing I hear is a dial tone. So he laughs at me in different ways, but it's a kind of a very interesting relationship. But I've never had that kind of relationship with a man in my life, okay? The way I grew up and where I grew up, you know, I was like, grew up with John Wayne, okay? And surrender was, you know, well, I'm not going to surrender, pilgrim, you know, under any circumstance. It was just, that's how we felt about it. I believed it was a cowardly thing to do and surrender and so forth and so on. And I went down and I spoke to Clancy about it, and I said, you know, I do not believe that I, you know, have the ability to surrender like it asked for, okay? And he said, let me ask you this. Do you think that you can act like you're surrendered? And I said, well, yeah, I've been acting all my life. You know, I'm such a phony and a liar that I think I could act as if I'm surrendered. He said, well, that's all you need to do. Just act like you're surrendered, okay? And that's what I did. I started acting like I would say to myself, what would a surrendered person say here, you know? And then I would say whatever a surrendered person would say, like, yes, you're right, dear. Okay, you know. Whatever it was, I just started acting. And you know, there's so much truth into the idea that, you know, we act ourselves into feeling better. That's what we do as alcoholics. I spent many, many, many an hour sitting on a bar stool trying to figure something out, you know, get the plan going. Think myself, you know, through this and feel better when I come out the other end. I never could think my way through it, but I found that I could act my way through something and come out the other end, you know, feeling better, because the actions start to change the way I feel. And I used to think I needed the feelings to change my actions, and it's just the complete opposite. So I started out by acting better than I felt. And you know, I started acting surrendered. And I started using that technique on everything, you know. And eventually I did, you know, reach a point where I realized that, you know, I probably am surrendered. And I kind of abandoned that idea of committing suicide. And I got this thing called hope. And you know, like I said, if you're new here tonight, I wish for you that you get the gift of hope, because it all springs from that. And don't let fear blow that little pilot light out, okay? Just, you know, bring some faith against it and walk through it and get some help. So I got this man that I was willing to talk to, like I never spoke to another man in my life. And I remember saying to him one time that I was afraid. I never told another man in my whole life that I was afraid. Never. I never sat at the bar and said to the guy next to me, I'm really afraid, you know. I may say, well, you dumb SOB, but, you know, whatever, and hit him over the head with a bottle, but I would never tell him I'm afraid. I just didn't do that. It wasn't the way I was brought up. I didn't believe that possible. So I told him that I was afraid, and he said to me probably the best thing he could have said. He said, I don't blame you. I would be afraid, too, if I were you. Like, well, thanks a lot, you know, like, aren't you supposed to pat me on the back and say, don't worry about it, pal, and, you know. But he said, I don't blame you. I'd be afraid, too. And you know, and you tell him, like, you know, I feel so guilty. He said, well, because you are. You know? Well, okay, you know, like, I hate that. So, you know, let's talk some solutions here. And the solution is just to walk through these things and come out the other end, you know, with some dignity and grace. And that's kind of what it's. My whole journey in AA has been just like that, learning how to do these, you know, the next indicated thing. How am I doing on time? 12 minutes. Okay. So I've learned to do it by doing it. Okay. I've stopped trying to you know, mentally, you know, gyrate things and figure things out and spend all this cerebral time, you know, thinking things through and so forth and so on, and just start taking the actions. And it's extremely important for a guy like me to take the actions when he's afraid, When I'm afraid to take the action, it's the most important. And I never, anytime I've ever taken that first step, whatever it is, towards solving a problem, I almost immediately begin to feel better. You know, and at the end of whatever that cycle is, that problem cycle, the end of the day, the end of the week, whenever, I always look back and say, I don't know what I was afraid of. This, you know, this was fine. That was particularly important to me when I did my ninth step, because I had a whole bunch of amends to make to, you know, people all over the place and people I didn't even know. But, you know, it always amazed me. I had maybe one person tell me that to make amends to him, what I could do is never cross his threshold again. And, you know, that was okay. I went and did what I was, you know, supposed to do. And if he didn't want to accept, you know, my amends and so forth and so on, then it's entirely up to him. I did what I needed to do. But by and large, the majority of people that I had to make amends to and did make amends to were gracious. And in some cases, they didn't even think that, they may not have known what I did, you know, which really pissed me off. I didn't have to tell them this. But, it didn't affect them half as much as I thought it did. You know, it bothered me more than it bothered them. It was kind of amazing that if you're new or fairly new and you're getting in the process of doing a nine step, talk it through with your sponsor. It's a very, it's a tricky step. It's a scary step, but it works wonders for you. It worked wonders for me, and I hope it will do for you. About 2 years ago, I moved from Orange County, California, up to Santa Barbara, and I just love it up there. AA is great in Santa Barbara. AA is great anywhere. I used to tell people, because I drank in New York and kind of grew up here and, you know, had a lot of wreckage in this town, I used to tell people, you know, I was the town drunk and everybody knew it, and I said the bad part was I'm from New York, you know. So the most difficult thing to face in all of this is just ourselves, you know, and coming to grips with it. And I would tell people that I don't think I could ever get sober in New York, and that's just not true. I mean, look at all of you. You could get sober wherever. Because I had somebody tell me the other day, oh, I used to live in Santa Barbara. I don't think I could ever get sober in Santa Barbara. You know, it's just our perception of, you know, how we think about it. You know, there's great AA in Santa Barbara. There's great AA here in New York. And there's great AA all over. I've had the opportunity to travel all over the world, you know, with business. And I've been to AA meetings all over. I've been to AA meetings where I didn't know a word they were saying. But I still, you know, you still kind of go, oh, yeah, this must be the part where he beat his wife. Like, oh, okay, you know. So, you know, it was just, you kind of know how the story's progressing. We know how, you know, how it goes. And you kind of, oh, yeah, and, you know, applaud at the right times. And, you know, they're right on. And then you shake the hand and say, that was a great talk. I can't, you know, absolutely amazing. And nobody comprehended one word of what was spoken. So I have fallen back in love again with New York. I think it's the weather. Okay? So I'm going to get out of here before it rains. But right now, it's just beautiful. This is such a great meeting. And like I said, you're such a handsome group. It's hard to believe that there's really an alcoholic in the room. So with that, I'll just say, you know, thank you very much for having me. And If you're ever in Santa Barbara, really come look me up. Or if you're you ever come out to the Pacific Group, ask for me. I'll be hanging around out there. But if you're new here tonight, I just want to leave you with one simple message. If you're new, get a God, get a book, and get it on, baby. Thank you.